This is channel 2 right. This is channel 2 right. This is channel 2 right. This is channel 2 right on the real Dr. Newberry. This is channel 2 right. This is channel 2 right on the real Dr. Newberry. This is towards the end of the visit on Monday, the 24th of March, 1969. Towards the end of the visit on Monday, the 24th of March, 1969.
Negro.
He said nigger.
Did he? I thought they called him Negro.
Now there you are. That's what I mean. That's been the attitude in the South. Now that attitude, it's been in the North too. When these things first started, Selma, Alabama, and Faubus, wherever, what was that town where Governor Faubus was in?
Arkansas. Little Rock.
Little Rock, Arkansas. Oh my, my Yankee friends. Yankee friends. So that's a shame the way you people treat the Negroes. I don't blame them for rebelling. I don't blame them for opposing the status quo. But when it started up north, we find that the Northerners have been worse towards the Negroes than the Southerners have.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yes, they had better schools to some extent. Their living was perhaps, I used to think was terrible the way the Negroes lived in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
until I got down, drove along, and saw what poor niggers living down here.
Mm-hmm.
You take on the way over to Tallahassee, not to Tallahassee, but to Pensacola, you pass hundreds of these that used to be Negro dwellings. They don't have windows. Just board them up with
no screen. Keep
no.
Heat of the house.
Door.
The cracks in the floor.
So, as bad as our residences were for homes, were for Negroes up north, they weren't that bad.
But well, now, the ministers don't just get up and say, this is what I think about it, but it always is...
It colors his preaching.
It's colored.
I have never gotten up and damned the white North or South. I think the South, more so than the North, have been victims of circumstance. I've always said that the North, or the leaders of the North after Lincoln died, were stupid. You know, we now know people that were the most rabid Lincoln haters are swallowing their tongues now. A few of them are daring to come out and say, we now know that if Lincoln had lived, we would never have the tragic episodes of the carpetbaggers.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, if you read history, there was a strong party within the Republican Party that was against Lincoln. And Seward was against him, talked behind his back, ran him down, and most of his cabinet members suffered with him only because he was a Republican and they had their jobs because of him.
Well, you get so you handle information better, you see, the more education you have. But so much, you don't have a great deal of ability amongst in the churches to handle information like
maybe,
that.
Maybe not to handle information.
To read and come out on
but
the right side.
You can, I don't like to use the word infiltrate, you know.
Indoctrinate.
Well, it is an indoctrination.
Influence,
any of those words might suffice, but they don't express one. In other words...
Well, now, if you're going to put it that way, Dr. Newberry, what you're doing, you see, that would be my position. I would say, now you ought to read these books, and I'll talk with you about them. And you see,
they won't do it, though.
As they talk, they will normalize their attitude. But now, as a minister, as you do that, you are actually not the minister. You're just taking my place.
Yeah, so I don't think that...
You think the minister still has to do that, or ought to, if he's qualified.
The trouble with too many...
Take the time to read it. The
trouble with too many preachers is that they let their pulpit become the place where they spew out their personal opinion.
Well, now that's what I wondered about. How does that work out?
Well, you get a racist. He'll stand up on the pulpit. He will deplore the people who...
Oh, he will?
Oh, yes. That's done commonly in these...
Well, now,
let
me tell you what Kenny Sims doesn't like. He doesn't like for the churches to take these walks that Martin Luther King
had.
Oh,
I detest that.
Yeah,
I detest that.
Yeah.
Just as much as I detest the walks which the Shriners take in a state or national convention.
Yeah.
I don't believe that God has called me to be a leader in insurrection.
Yeah.
Probably he's called any man. It's all good and well. And I have always had a great deal of silent admiration for Martin Luther King. But subsequent events have proven to us that Martin Luther King was not the great advocate of change by peaceful methods that he preached. When you lead a march, as he did when he was killed, you are courting disaster.
Yes, you're courting disaster. You're courting all sorts of reactionary...
I think that Martin Luther's assassination was the result of his own stupidity.
Yeah, he went so far.
And God knows how can anyone support the... what they call it, Poverty City in Washington?
Oh, yeah. Resurrection City.
Resurrection City.
Yeah, that was sort of...
Oh, that was a travesty.
You know, I have heard people say this. I'm not sure that I've heard them say this, but this is the way I would re-say it. Now, it's a fine thing, you see, for the churches or any organization to, you know, examine all these social troubles and try to find out more and take a more humane attitude toward them. But by and large, what a person feels in church he wants to do there is to have a little peace and quiet. It's one place you can go that's sort of neutral ground. You don't feel like the preacher is going to come up and hunt you, or the ushers are going to kick you on the shin.
Of course, the collection plate hits you.
Yes. And nobody's going to jab you. It's sort of neutral territory. And you know, it's hard to go. We used to go to the barbershop, you know, and find a pleasant place to sit for an hour. But you can't do that anymore.
No.
If you go, they don't talk much, and if they do talk, it's something you don't want to hear. Or, you know, it's the old homogeneity of what you call it, gone. You don't get that fellow feeling.
I think we can sum up my position as to what my place should be in all of these social controversies, which have to do not directly with the church, but it has to do with the church people. The matter of fair wages. The matter of Vietnam. The matter of integration. And so forth. I feel that if you are a Christian, And that Christ has been presented to you in such a way that you have made a personal commitment to him. The Holy Spirit is going to lead you and direct your conscience to do the better things. Not always the best, but the better things.
Well, don't you ever feel that that's limited in a way? I feel sometimes, you see, when I go to church or whenever I leave the office, I'm sort of bruised and battered. I just look like there's one blow after another. It's not a body blow. It's not kill me.
That which is worse.
But it's not still. The waters are not still. And there's no, where I am, there's no, what do you call it?
Calm.
Yeah. Well, you can talk and think a little bit and calm.
Hello?
That one thing would be a great help if it didn't do anything else. Of course, it would do other things, too. But just give a person a little neutral ground there for a while where somebody's not going to grab him.
That's why I do not believe that the Pope is a place for the minister to hash over the things that people can read in the newspapers.
Yes, yes.
I remember in Pekin, Illinois, we had a congregational minister who didn't know whether Jesus Christ was a Chinaman or a flagpole sitter. And all he would do was read some Reader's Digest or Time or some of those magazines. Now, one of his members, a lawyer, said to me one day, "I don't need to go to church to hear the Reader's Digest. I can read." And he was furious. Now, of course, I don't believe that a minister has any right to approach these problems on any other ground than a spiritual ground.
Now the young tenant came in, and it was time for me to go anyhow, so we called a halt, and this is about 135 on Channel 2 Right. Channel 2 Right, about 135, and this is the end of the visit with Dr. and Mrs. Newberg on Monday, the 24th of March, 1969. And this is about 135 on Channel 2 Right, Channel 2 Right, the end of the visit with Dr. and Mrs. Newberg on Monday, the 24th of March, 1969. This is a visit with Reverend Lewis on Wednesday, the 7th of May, 1969, at his house over on Northeast 6th Street. About on the way home, I'd been trying to catch him for a long time. He's out all day visiting. And I can't just run out of the office for half an hour and talk to somebody on subjects like this. Well, I rang the doorbell a time or two. The television was on. And I hadn't quite given him time to eat. So I told him I needed to do a little paperwork, and he finished. And he sat by himself at the end of the table over in the dining room. And right quietly went ahead by himself. I don't know where his wife was. And I thought what a powerful man he had been. Big frame. He's not as heavy as he was. And big voice. Oh, that voice would do remarkable things. He doesn't use it much now, you know. Person has to whisper. And all the experience he's had, I wanted to ask him about the old-time conversion. I got into that through the Scarlet Letter. And this one little girl in class, and I studied it through Emerson's Divinity School address. At least I looked at it in that light. And at some point in our talk, I restated that and said what I figured the substance of the old conversion was. It's what I set down on a piece of paper. I have a note on that, and I'll attach it to this tape. But that comes to him, you see. He does. It bears upon him with experience. He has that feeling of all the trouble and misunderstanding we get into on such small matters the fence rows, as Hawthorne might say, the dark parts of the heart. Then, as Emerson starts out in the Divinity School address, the minister or the scholar first comes to life with that feeling that he sees in himself a just act. And then he sees just acts that other people do. And he comes to that idea that there is an abstract justice. And the world looks different. That's something above the ordinary. That's the extraordinary. The divine. And that gives consistency to the world. Now, Hawthorne and Emerson then talk, almost assume, you see, that that point will be reached by a rather violent experience inside. A person be turned round, upside down, somewhere along the line. It's a fight, it's a battle, like Paul on the road to Damascus. But that assumes a considerable maturity, and that a man has lived and has experience and understands his experience. He looks at it. And this was on Wednesday afternoon, the 7th of May, 1969, at Reverend Lewis's house over on Northeast 6th Street, just off 8th Avenue. We talked a good while, but the main part of it was what he told me about conversion.
A man saw the light. And he never the same anymore. And it wasn't this little civic thing that it's good to be good to your neighbor. No. It was something greater, more powerful than that.
Not simply social service.
Yes. Now, to talk about that a little, what was the ingredients of that?
Well, of course, that was written in a different intellectual climate.
Yes.
And a different spiritual climate. A different orientation to what we have. Now, I go along with that.
Yes.
Fully and completely.
Yes.
And I think we're missing the boat.
Yes.
In substituting a new form of Judaism.
Yes.
Maybe a more difficult Judaism, by the way.
Yes.
For the old Judaism. And we're substituting it for Christ himself. For instance, we're taking the Sermon on the Mount and say, let us follow the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is a code of ethics, we want to say ethics, our conduct, for the followers of Christ. And it presupposes a commitment to Christ. And without the commitment to Christ, it is utterly, wholly impossible and impractical, even the spirit of it, for the non-Christian. Now, that brings in a lot of questions. Well, what about these people that are not non-Christian? That are not Christian? We have to believe that Christ is cosmic, or he is not adequate for this universe. And we have to believe that he's a light that lights every man coming into the world. And that is what John says. That imposes upon every man to follow the light that is within him. And as he does that, the circle of light enlarges. He becomes a broader man, and he may come to the place where the demands of him on him are so great that he says, as Paul did, I can't do it. I have to be another person before I can do this thing. And that's the basis for conversion.
Well, now, what did Paul see that made it overwhelmed him like that he can't do?
Well, he had the demand of the Old Testament law, and he was a man of keen insight.
Yeah.
And all the time the law was saying, don't covet
yeah.
in substance.
Yeah.
Yet he was coveting.
Yeah.
Don't be selfish, yet he was selfish. So that he lived in the 7th chapter of the book of Romans until Christ came into the picture, the latter part of that chapter. And in the 8th chapter, he comes into a fellowship with Christ. And what he could not do, in that he was weak because of the flesh, he could do
in through the Spirit.
Power, in the Spirit, through the power of Christ.
Well, now, how does one come into the Spirit? He don't just walk into it.
No, it's a matter of total commitment to Christ.
Well, it's got to be, would you say, something that upsets you.
Oh, absolutely. You're not going to commit your life to Christ just in a daydream.
Yeah.
No, sir.
Well, now, brothers, let me tell you. I was brought up with this lady. She is the age of my mother. And she sang at all the weddings and sermons and funerals. And the tears would always run down her cheeks. Well, now, she didn't do that, you see, through any little civic virtue.
It wasn't an affectation with her.
No. Now, you see, something violent had happened to her. Some new conception, you see, had come to her. Now, what does that consist of? Outside of theological language. What is it a man gets a hold of that enables him to see that?
Well, we'll have to use a religious term. It's the Spirit of God that gets hold of him. And he responds to this Spirit. And he responds to the light that comes to him. And when he does, he is led into a larger realm of life. Now, eventually, there will come a time when he'll have to say yes to God. I'll have, you'll be my king, you'll be my Lord. Or I'll be boss. It's one or the other. And if I'm boss, I've already made a mess of myself. And that's what humanity is doing now. And that's what the church is doing right now.
Well, look, how would you explain just, you know, it used to be the conversion was public.
Yes.
And people said something about it, you see. And you see what happened. Now, what is that experience that they had then?
It's bound to be a conversion experience.
What does that consist of?
It consists of an impartation of a new factor in life, which is the kingship of Christ.
Well, how does it affect them? It sort of turns them over inside.
Oh, it turns them over. Would you mind if I give my own experience?
I wish you would, if you don't mind.
I don't mind. I was reared in the home of a local Methodist preacher, my grandfather. It was a good home. My grandfather was a good man. My grandmother wasn't allowed a professor of religion. I don't know that she was always quite satisfied with what she was as a Christian. But we went to church, and they taught me high ideas. But nevertheless, I got to running around with the community boys, and they'd curse. But we were not vulgar. My besetting sin was vulgarity. It was cursing. Not vulgarity. It was cursing. And I'd hold grudges. And mean grudges.
Yeah.
And then store up in.
Yeah.
Now then, at the age of 17, there came into our community an epidemic of diphtheria. And there's nothing new but let people die. They just die.
Yeah.
Unless they could overcome it some way.
What year was that?
That was 1908. And so many of my schoolmates were dying. I took the diphtheria. And I remember my pulse got down to, they told me 32. They were giving me strychnine then. So it weakens the heart, you know, and you pass out. I wasn't suffering particularly. But I faced up to the matter of life and death. And the question was whether I would be a Christian or not. And there's a little spell in there when I said, well, I'll be a better boy. But I found that instead of being better, I was meaner. See? You had a little period in there when I got up and went out hunting. And seemed like it just eased the pain in me to curse. That's a strange thing.
Yeah.
But I relapsed. And it was then that my illness showed up more pronounced. And then I reasoned this way. If there is such a thing as eternity, and such a thing as morality, and such a thing as happiness, and such a place as hell, it's a very foolish thing to have your little fling of fun now and spend eternity in torment. That was my reason. And finally it came to this place where as I searched my heart, things loomed up in my mind that I'd hardly thought about that were wrong. I'd just taken things for granted, and particularly swearing. And another was hatred.
Grudges.
And would I forgive? Another was, would I be willing to witness for Christ, regardless? Because I knew of no Christian young people in my school. And I knew I'd stand out like a sore thumb. And I thought I'd be ridiculed. And I had to face that, and it's a hard thing to face. But as I searched my heart, and as the Spirit of the Lord, I believe, reveal these things to me, I gradually said a final yes. And that afternoon that I was converted, my mother was out in the field praying for me. And I didn't know it at the time, but I learned later that she told the Lord if he would let me live, she'd dedicate me or consecrate me to the ministry. I didn't know anything about it. But she came in and I told her my experience. I hadn't said anything about it. Now I said, Mother, I've done all I know to do. Well, she said, I heard Brother Yates, and I didn't know Brother Yates. I heard Brother Yates preach the other Sunday. And he said the way to become a Christian, if you're going the wrong way, is to turn around and go the right way. And trust the Lord.
Yeah.
And that sparked something in me.
Yeah.
And as I did that, why, behold, I was a changed person.
Yeah.
Literally a changed person. Formerly, I thought I'd have to try.
You just felt it.
Oh, yes. I thought that I'd have
to. And there was no urge to go backwards anymore.
No urge to go backwards. And I had formerly thought that I'd have to live a Christian ideal or a Christian practice being the old person that I was.
Yeah.
And I knew that'd be a hard job. Just making myself doing something all the time I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
That would be terrific, and I knew that.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, when I finally trusted the Lord to forgive me of my sins, and I had fully repented, and repenting means just what Mother said, turn around and go the other way.
Yeah.
Why, behold, I was a new person.
Yeah.
And where formerly I had taken the Lord's name in vain in almost every sentence, why, I had no more inclination to swear than if I'd never sworn.
Yeah.
And I didn't hate the boys. And I didn't fear them.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, they didn't scorn me for becoming a Christian. They respected me.
But a lot of work went in on that.
Oh, a lot of work went in on that.
You worked hard on it. You struggled on it.
I struggled on it.
backslid and everything.
Yes. Now then, it's impossible for, in my judgment, this is a bit of philosophy, for a non-Christian to live a Christian life.
Yeah.
And we're trying these days to enforce a Christian ethic on a people that have never made a commitment to Christ.
Yeah.
And that's our status right now.
Now, Brother Yates, when he preached that sermon, you know, there is something in the voice of a man who has command of his voice that sort of does more than printed words will do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The voice in the pulpit is one
yes.
of our greatest forces.
One of the greatest forces.
Today.
One of the greatest forces.
And when the pulpit loses its royalty.
Yes.
And its authority.
Yes.
We are in a pathetic plight.
You don't have that high point.
You don't have it.
You just don't have it.
We are.
Bless well.
How glad I am you came. I'm glad to have privilege of telling this.
I didn't know. I just don't know those things. But I think about them a lot. And I see this with the...
I told him those things that we face all the time, those little restrictions, those little inhibitions, prohibitions that the students feel just amongst themselves. There's so few things that are important to them they can actually talk about. And I thought about Dimmesdale's temptation in the Scarlet Letter to tell that elderly woman, you see, who lived in hope of being of joining those old friends and her family. Just the temptation that he had to tell her to all just forget all that rubbish about the hereafter. And you see, with public opinion, I guess the hereafter goes. Now, the next part is various little subjects, just odds and ends. The principal part was what I've had already on confession.
I have a feeling that would not be accepted, General. Church is trying to substitute a naturalism for the supernatural.
Yes.
And it can't be done. And Christianity, if it isn't an imposition of the supernatural upon the natural, it isn't anything. It's a farce. And if man is left to himself, it's kind of like a Methodist preacher. I heard him give me a testimony in 1913, I guess, or 14, in Meridian, Mississippi. Bishop Arthur Moore was preaching over there, in his young ministry. And Moore was always a good preacher. And I probably was in Moore's meeting to have a good preacher. And this Methodist preacher had three lovely children in school. Two boys studying Greek, young fellows, lovely daughter. Well, he'd have made a mess of life. So he'd been on fraud. But there he was in his community trying to face it and go on with it. And he did. So down here at this meeting. And he gave this testimony. I guess it came out of his own experience, but I think he stated a universal principle. He said, I've come to the conclusion that no man left to himself is adequate to the demands of life.
Well, I tried to switch to some neutral subjects, just get off on the weather. He told me about some of the things he'd been doing. He visited And he has these little cards that he follows up and talks to various people. Now, here's one of the great spirits, one of the fine ministers, just spending his days out in the parish, so to speak, talking about making arrangements to take care of the children so the parents can get to church, I guess.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Like, I guess I have some cards in my pocket now. I got a big pack in the office. And here's what they'll give me. Here they are. See that?
Yeah.
Now, I've just got doodles of them. Here's one. Had one I called on and went home.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know whether it's home or not. Here's some more.
Now, this is a U.F. student. Now, my experience with the students over there is that they don't know what they can.
He is Lutheran, and I don't know what his... No, he's Lutheran. And I don't know what her background is. Then there's another family down there in the same building. I've gone there 4 or 5 times where I found them home.
Yeah.
Finally found them home, very intelligent. But he is going to Egypt, and many of them ask some very keen questions. But so many of them, you see, the way we get our names, we get those that come to church when they sign the registry.
Yeah.
And the very fact that they're in church shows that they have some interest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the run of mine, yeah. Student.
Yeah.
It's a student that has some manifest interest, and usually the membership is somewhere else.
Yeah.
But so many times they say, "Well, I'm going to only be here till August, September, into the May, or whatnot," and therefore it's not worthwhile for me to join. I'll be here a year, and we'll just keep our membership in Mount Hill of Venus.
No.
It does employ our time,
yeah.
But. I talked to a lady this morning. I said, "Why don't you come to our prayer meeting? We have a prayer circle down here. I could build it up to a large group, but I'm a subordinate pastor. I don't care about building up a circle in which I'm a particular leader. I'm trying to let it take its own course." So the pastor in charge will not think, "Well, Lewis is taking a little too much authority here. I don't want to do that." But anyway, I said to her, I said, "Why don't you come to our family?" Well, she said, "I've been going to the Eastern Star about every Tuesday." And she said, I've been leaving my daughter at home, 13-year-old daughter, going to the Eastern Star. And she said, "The Lord rebuked me for that." And said, "I've sent home my daughter." Well, I said, "That's one of the best things you can possibly do." "Well, the best thing you could possibly do."
Yeah.
"I feel my duties there." Well, I said, "I feel it too."
Yeah.
But that was a fine confession, wasn't it?
Yeah.
She's at church every Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Sits near the aisle.
Yes, sir.
And here's another experience. I forget just what it is.
He came out lieutenant, had some narrow escapes. He finished law at University of Tennessee. And he got pretty wild. He was the next thing to an alcoholic. And then he got to Common Guard Church. And he was running around a bit, and I knew it. But he and I'd have a good time together. We'd talk together. He'd come to my office, my study, and we would talk. Finally, I said to Cliff, I said, "Cliff, why don't you get down here in some of these country towns and get you a nice, sweet girl and marry her?" Well, he did. I married her married them on Christmas Day. Sweetwater, Tennessee. Cliff was converted in a revival meeting in the heart of Knoxville, a revival that I put on almost over the protest of my official board. I had to scheme like everything to get that revival. And I got a great preacher to come there who had pastoral experience. He was just simply an evangelist. He was one of the outstanding pastors of Indiana. So he preached. And two young men came out of that church as a result of that meeting and made ministers. One of them was Cliff Ingram. He went to the altar and he prayed and wrestled, and I talked to him, and I couldn't do a thing. Well, my brother had given his life to evangelism, and he was directing the singing. And he got hold of Cliff right off and cornered him. It wasn't any time until Cliff made it a profession. I said to my brother, I said, what was wrong? Well, I said, he didn't believe in Jesus Christ. Said finally, when that matter was settled, it wasn't any time until he made his profession. And he's now in the Tennessee Conference preaching in the vicinity of Nashville. He finished at Vanderbilt University and could have finished head of class. But he saw it was generating some contention on the part of a contender for first honor. He just let the other fellow out first honor. But there he was, a young lawyer, a member of a law firm, and not one of the best law firms. And he quit that up, and then gave that up, and then went to Vanderbilt. He got his bachelor's divinity degree and went to preach. Another one of those boys is down here at Tampa now, Jack Kelly. And he's a marvelous preacher. At least minister, and I suppose he's a preacher. He's a very close student. In fact, he's a closer student than Ingram. And he's doing a fine job down there.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a meeting that I practically had to force through.
Well, now, who was the minister? I don't.
It is approach. If you reason too much, you lose your appeal.
Why, he declared, he affirmed. You'd almost call it a dogmatic approach.
Yeah.
It was an affirmative approach.
Yeah.
He had a gospel to preach.
Yeah.
Without a pulse.
Yeah.
With no compromise.
Yeah.
And he emphasized the person of Christ and the power of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And a Christless pulpit's an awful thing. And to try to reach inside of a man's soul without the help of the Holy Spirit is an impossible job.
Well, now, he can't do that and talk just in a quiet way, Brother Lewis. He's got to put something into it.
Well, he was an eloquent preacher. Yes, he was an eloquent preacher. But, however, I think that Jonathan Edwards was a quiet preacher. I've been told that. You take, who is this man that has had such influence in translating languages? You know who I mean?
I'll tell you, man, Frank Loebach. Frank Loebach has had tremendous influence in translating languages or getting languages into written form. More so than I guess any other man in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear him talk, he talks with a quiet power.
Oh.
And I've been in retreat with
him. Oh, really?
Yes. And it is not the loudness of his voice.
Yeah.
It's the quality of the thing.
Oh, really?
And the sincerity of his soul.
Oh.
And if he makes an appeal for prayer, people respond without any hesitancy, you might say, without much battle.
Looks like it'd be awful hard to do. I guess he trains himself.
Well, he was an educator.
Yeah.
And then, in his going into a community, a primitive community, to teach those people a written language.
Yeah.
Putting it on a board or chart and getting them to recognize a few simple words so they would begin to read and then put the scripture in their hands. It's an amazing thing what results.
Mm-hmm.
And but his power was literally it's amazing.
Well, over on the campus, raise our voice anymore. Again, back quiet. And the direction of it can't be too strong. That is, you can't make an appeal. It just has to be the direction there. They see, these chaps are pretty bright, you know, awfully bright. And it's pretty hard to see sometimes not to, you know, put something into it. But if you do, you lose them. And they're polite, they'll listen, but they turn you off, you know. That's curious, isn't it?
Now we'll come out of that. There will come a time when there will be such compulsion that redemptive truth will be declared with a great soul passion.
Yeah.
Because we won't stand this slow response forever. This is a little temporary thing in the cycle of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now our own nation could be on a toboggan slide from which it'll never recover. I don't know. Nobody knows. Nobody knows when some man will rise up as refugee in England and bring about a great awakening. We just don't know what the Lord has. You can't predict history. You can kind of get the implication of philosophy.
Yeah.
Say, if this is true, then this other must be true.
And this is another experience.
And anyway, Chairman of the Board said, now the time of revivals are over. And he said, we'll have to reach people by going to their homes. I'd asked him to make an announcement about a visitation campaign. And I had a sermon that morning on evangelism, where Paul says, I am become all things to all men, that by all means I might win some. That's my text. So I'm going to cover the whole spectrum of approach to people, including pulpit evangelism. And so chairman of a board got up and said, the day of pulpit evangelism is over. Well, he's just cutting clear across my sermon, you know. But I let him go on. But when it came to my sermon, I said, I'll have to differ a little with Brother Lowe. He'd run for governor of the state, so he's a pretty strong man. I said, it's my conviction that the gospel preached consistently will have its effect today. And I said, there's a place for a pulpit evangelist. Well, it's out of that evangelist. And they hadn't had I don't guess they'd had a convert in that church for 20 years, anybody knew anything about. That's little to the truth. They'd gone through the ceremony, the ritual. And had things nice, in choir.
Yeah.
Nobody excited.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people going to the door.
Yeah.
Especially in our church.
Yeah.
And it's a sad thing. It's a sad thing now that here we are. The non-church is passing us by. It's passing us by.
Yeah.
And they sense. They might not spell it out. But if they were to spell, they'd spell it out that they're not particularly wanted, especially the average working class of people.
Yeah.
Are not wanting in the stilted churches.
Yes, that's right.
Now they just aren't.
Yes.
And we can say they'd be welcome, but I doubt that.
Yeah, I doubt that.
If they were welcome, we would make them feel welcome.
Yes.
And they'd say, what a good time I had.
Yes.
And a lot of our talk about mission is lip service. Church having a mission. That's lip service.
Yeah.
And it'll have a mission when the preacher and the layman recognizes the need of the common man, however unfortunate his plight. Now, this thing's not on, is it?
No.
I'll give an example, and I don't want to give it in any boastful way, but as an illustration. About a year ago, maybe not quite a year ago, a man came here, he's a painter, and he's just begging for work. And he'd been offered to work for 50 cents an hour. Well, our house didn't need painting. Well, it needed painting pretty bad, these window screens, etc., trimming. And I came in and said, Hazel, this man needs some work, and we have our house trimmed. She said, can we afford it? Well, I said, here's a man that's hungry with a family. I said, we have to afford it. So I went and borrowed the money, had him do this, give him a job. Well, the poor fellow, here he was, light turned off, I mean, power turned off,
mm-hmm.
Rent due.
Yeah.
No groceries.
Oh, when you owe money, when you are short of money, there's more bills. Oh,
and then he told me later, he said, I'd consider him suicide.
Yeah.
Now, the result is, we got him to do that. I gave him another work around that. I wasn't able to afford it. Then he wanted to, came here again not long ago, wanted to paint the inside of our home. Well, there it was, desperate. Well, he'd have painted it for a song almost, but we gave him $2 an hour. He painted every room. Well, this is something that's quite comforting. His old car wore out. He had a yellow painting down at Cedar Keys. And somebody sold him an old car for about $400 or $500. And it just drank oil like a camel drink of water.
Yeah.
And the poor boy had that.
Yeah.
So he had no means of transportation. Well, my wife had been keeping count of the money she owed the Lord on a tithing basis for some about ever since we'd been married. Have been tied around. And she owed him about $600-$700. Well, we had two cars. And showed that tired money. He had no car. And it came to us separately. It came to me, it came to her. She mentioned it to me, and I'd been thinking about it. Letting him have that 58 Chevrolet, and it's an ad. It's an ad. But he got $350, $400 for it. I said, well, If you want to know what it's worth, I said, be worth at least $300. And I said, why don't you give that to him and credit your obligation, tithing obligation, that much. So we give it to him. And he got it right now.
Yeah.
So he's got his family together.
Yeah.
And he knows I love him.
Yeah.
And I'd invite him down here to this church, but what could I do with him when he got in there?
Yeah.
Couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
He'd just be lost.
Just be lost.
So I'm inviting him, and he's going to church up there.
I'm lost over there.
Who is?
That's the reason I go out in the country. I just feel awful. Awful lost over there. That's not.
I don't say who is.
Not anybody's fault, but my own, you see. I don't mean.
No, but what we've done.
Well, that's the end of that marvelous little session on Wednesday afternoon late with Reverend Lewis over at his very nice, clean, beautiful little house on Northeast 6th Street on Wednesday, the 7th of May, 1969. And this is Channel 2 Right, around 760. Around 760, Channel 2 Right. And the end of that remarkable little session with Reverend Lewis, the first part on conversion.
You just enjoy hunting with a good dog.
Yes. Enjoy hunting sometime with a bad dog if you can't get a good dog. You want me to speak about that?
About the dog, if you're a bad dog.
I've had many. One of the most satisfactory dogs that I ever had was a Weimaraner by the name of Joe, who was an all-purpose dog. He was a fine retriever. He would not hunt too far away from you. He had a good disposition. He would clear any fence if you had killed a bird and would bring the birds back to you. Mm-hmm. He lived to be 10 years old, and I've never seen old Joe's equal.
Well, now, did you take care of yourself?
What do you think that took care of? Well, you want me to keep on talking? Is that enough?
No.
Joe and I hunted in the area where Mr. Myers lives, at least about 6 or 8 miles south of there, not far from Reddick. One day we put up, three coveys got up on a line fence there. And they all were scattered at the end of this hedge, and we had some very remarkable shooting and retrieving and pointing on the part of Joe. Cocker spaniels were part of my love for dogs a good many years ago. I had Deacon and Elder, who were famous in a dove field. They got my doves and everybody else's. And they would not deliver any of the doves to anybody but to me. There have been some big tales told about this, most of which isn't so. I then had Noah and Nicodemus. They too were Cocker Spaniels, and contrary to the opinion of many people, I hunted quail with these dogs. They would not point, but they would trail and hesitate just a minute before the birds got up. And then when the birds were scattered, they would root out all of the singles and never lose a dead bird. I've had Molly and Belle, and presently an old bitch that I call Mrs. Smith. She is now in the state of Mississippi, where she hunted with me for about 6 weeks last winter, in the last of December and through most of January, around soybean fields. The coveys were a large covey last year, due, I think, to the fact that a lot of the soybeans shelled out and there was abundance of food for them.
I could go on and to the remote past and tell you about Chum and Tig and Togo, but that and Jeff, but that is more ancient history, and so we will let it do it that, and I think this is sufficient.
All right.
Good.
Now, you've got your eye on that dog all the time when he's out there.
I had my eye on him.
Yeah.
Yeah, anybody does.
And you know when he's getting warm and getting up on the...
Sure. Well, you didn't want me to elaborate on that, did you? I just gave you the high point.
No, I just talked to you.
Sure. Old Joe was a very fine dog. It was an exception. Many people say with Vamorana, not all of them that way. Mm-hmm. They're smart dogs, nice pets, nice to have around.
You know, I've seen those dogs.
Yes.
But I never knew they would hunt.
Oh, yes. And particularly, old Joe came from Austria. He was whelped over there. And an army colonel. Incidentally, I got an invitation to this man's daughter's wedding today, named Lawrence. He lives now down in Mineola.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the dam. And gave me this puppy when I guess he was about 4 months old. He was a big dog, and he grew to be a very handsome dog. He weighed 80 pounds, I expect.
Mm-hmm.
Stayed in the house a lot of the time, and he never violated any of the proprieties. He was just a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And the children used to come here, my brother's children used to come here, and grandchildren wallow over him, and he would just meekly accept it all. He never would, I never knew him to snap at anybody.
Yeah.
He was just, one of the gentlest, nicest dogs that I've ever known.
I always thought dogs understood children pretty well.
Well,
they didn't make them nervous.
The trouble about children is they don't mean to be that way, but they are rough with dogs and they squeeze them and sometimes hurt them. They don't mean that. They're trying to show affection for them. It's a little dog I've got here now. Do you want to see a fine bird dog?
Yes.
All right. I think he'd come out and speak to you.
Hello there.
Yes,
hello
there. Like everybody.
Hello
there. Tackle any dog that will possibly.
Well, hello there.
Yeah, he's a nice little dog.
Well, now, he's not going to make a breath dog.
Oh, no.
He just
a chihuahua dog.
Sure.
He's just a little pet.
Yeah.
A dog is not only owned by anybody for the return he gives you practically hunting, but he's a pet. He gets to be funny. He's gone over there and with his health.
Yeah.
And he wants to make up to everybody.
Do you remember this man out there in that Fairfield area? Who used to hunt a whole lot, had dogs.
Mr. Williams? Williams?
The name that comes to me is Rush.
Oh, no, Mr. Rush never hunted. He had foxhounds. I've hunted on fox hunting many, many times, Mr. Rush.
Yeah.
You ought to know him. He lived there in McIntosh.
Yeah.
Sure, I knew. Well, he never hunted in all the long period of time that I knew him. He lived 2 miles west of McIntosh.
Yeah.
That's now Atlanta, now a stock farm.
Yeah.
Old man Rush was a very fine person. I've been with him many, 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 many times, and some other old men down there. I'm not a fox hunter. I used to go with them.
And listen to the dog.
The Reynolds boys, you know, and let me see, one fellow who lived there at McIntosh, I had his funeral service 2 or 3 years ago in the McIntosh cemetery. I can't remember what his name was. Right at this time, it slipped me. The Reynolds boys lived down, the men, they lived down near Ready. And we used to go out there in a very thick area beyond where Mr. Rush lived. And
that's the middle of the visit with Preacher Gordon. That's the end of Channel 2, right? The visit on Thursday, the 8th of May, 1969. I'll finish it on Channel 2 over. I just turn it over now, Channel 2 over, and finish this visit with Preacher Gordon on Thursday, the 8th of May, 1969.